From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
If it thaws outside, should I clean up now? Or what if I do and then the weather gets freezing cold again? And what am I doing wrong with my African violets? These and many more of your urgent garden questions will be tackled on today's show by me and my friend and fellow garden writer, Ken Drews. But first, these messages.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach made possible from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners, farmers, and homesteaders with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/AwayToGarden. Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
We've got Ken Drews on the line via Skype, as we do each month. Hello, Ken.
Oh, Margaret, my goodness.
I know, we haven't even said anything. We're already laughing. Something about the two of us, we just laugh at each other all the time. So we've got a staff.
We're not laughing at each other.
Together. We're laughing in unison. Okay.
With each other.
With each other. So we've got a stack of listener and reader questions. But before we dig in, let's tell everybody how it works. Should anyone wish to ask a question of their own, they can always ask us anything, urgent or otherwise, on Facebook.com/AwayToGarden or in comments on the Away to Garden website, or on KenDrews.com, or using the contact form on either one of our websites. So, got the housekeeping out of the way. What do you think? Should we answer some questions?
Oh, well, why not? We're here. You know,
okay, right. Okay. So, from Kate on awaytogarden.com in the comments, Kate is in Long Island Zone 7B. She says she is so anxious for spring. She keeps going outside to see if her hellebores are blooming. She's been getting sporadic warm days and then going back to freezing. But on the warm days, should she start like clearing some of the leaves off the garden beds or leave everything there? She's ready to do spring cleanup, but she doesn't want to remove some kind of warmth or protection if that's what's better for the plants. So, Ken, I don't suppose there's actually like a perfect right or wrong answer here, but what's your sort of theory for this?
Now, you just got that question, right? You just got it.
Yes.
And it's the beginning of February
yes.
when we're talking.
Yes.
So I would say leave it, because the groundhog says we're going to have more winter.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's funny when the days get warm, it's like, oh, okay, I'm ready. I'm going to go out there and start cleaning up. It's spring. And we could have plenty of snow, and it could be very cold again. So I would say just leave things as long as you can, as long as it doesn't drive you insane.
Yeah.
Just leave stuff on the garden. You know, sometimes when you do, though, some things like leaves get kind of slimy, and it's
yeah.
a drag, and that's unfortunate, but that does happen sometimes. But I'd say if you can, leave stuff in place.
So one of the things, if I have cabin fever, which it sounds a little bit like Kate, you know, is anxious and she wants to see the hellebores and stuff like that. So for instance, my hellebores, I might on a day that's what I would call a January thaw or a February thaw, you know, I might go out and carefully pick the matted leaves off them because they're going to come into bloom soon, right? So I don't want a big wads of stuff on them when they're starting to push their flowers. Or say I know I have winter aconite, Aranthus hyemalis, you know, little tiny bulbs that are going to
yeah.
come in March, right? And mm-hmm. I think and I see, oh my goodness, you know, a bunch of oak leaves blew in where that big patch of Aranthus is. I might do a little like strategic, you know, lift, but not in general, not a wholesale cleanup. And if I'm really cabin fevery, and say there's a lot of leaves that scuttled into the driveway or onto the patio, like I'll do in the hardscape areas. You know, I'll
oh, sure.
give myself a little chore, you know, to make myself feel better. But it's when the lawn when the lawn is frozen and or wet or both, sometimes frozen below but mushy on top, it's really damaging to the soil and to the grass. And do you know what I mean? It's not good to go stomping around
sure.
or pushing a wheelbarrow, right? So,
absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So we're basically saying leave it, maybe a little tiny bit of target removal, both to make you feel good, and if it's some really early thing that you know is going to come up after a couple more thaws, okay. Okay, glad we figured that out, Ken. We have a houseplant question from Gloria. And she says she is having trouble with jade and plant and African violets, two houseplants that she just doesn't have success with, even though, you know, there are always in those books that say these are the easy houseplants. She assumes it's a watering problem. And she says it's difficult to judge sort of too frequent or too little water. And she'd like to know, like, what do we think is, you know, how should she be taking care of these plants, kind of best advice? Do you grow either one? Have you grown either one? I had a jade plant, but yeah.
Both of them.
Yeah.
And I think she's exactly right. It's a water problem.
Always with these.
And it sounds like too much water for both of them.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, all the books say that African violets want to be evenly moist.
Yeah.
Which is hard to figure out what that means exactly.
Right.
But the tendency is to overwater them because they're in a very kind of soggy, peaty mix that stays wet too long and squeezes out the oxygen. And then you always get those fungus gnats, you know, those little tiny gnats flying around.
I don't love them.
They don't really
eat
plants. They eat, but they're a sign that there's decaying matter in the soil.
And it's too wet.
The cure for that is less water. And with the jade plant, I would hardly water it at all through the whole, for at least January, February.
So, you know, it's interesting because I remember reading, there's like an African Violet Society of America, and it has chapters all around the country because, you know, people show their violets, and it's like a big, you know, it's a popular plant. And I remember reading a couple things about the watering in particular that stuck with me that I didn't really know, but it kind of makes sense. First of all, never cold water on them, that makes sense, and never get water on their foliage. And that's true of the jade plants, too, and that's true of a lot of things. You know, you really don't want to be, like, pouring especially cold water on their leaves. But never, for the African violets, never water from a water softener system.
Wow.
So, you know, because those salts, you know, these plants are in a little pot and you get these salts building up and it's not a good thing. So, you know, I have to have a water softener system because I have a well and it's just what it is. And so that's one of those things that sometimes can backfire to look worth looking into. And highly chlorinated water is also not good for them.
Not.
But standing in water, like people leave the saucers underneath while they're watering and they leave the saucer underneath the plant and then the thing stands there. And that, I think, is the worst of all. With the jades, they're funny because they're succulent and mm-hmm. you know, but, they can drop their leaves. You'd think, oh, they don't need water at all. Like you said, in the dead of winter, probably very little. But the leaf drop can happen, you know, they can sort of sulk and drop their leaves if they get too dry. So they can get too dry. So we can underwater them even though they're succulents. So I think that, it's important that during active growth, which I think is in our summer months where mm-hmm. we live, you know, they need more water than you might, not tons, but they need more water than you might think. And you can back off in the winter, but you don't want to. So it's not the same watering schedule all year long with either of these, but especially the jade is what I also would want to say, experiment with. And plus, with the jade, it really needs that sharp drainage, you know, that sort of cactus and succulent mix kind of soil. And when that's, I used to have a big old jade and it, you know, it had been in the pot a long time and yeah, it can handle it, but there wasn't much soil left, soil, quote unquote, you know, there wasn't, it was kind of, it didn't have good drainage anymore. You know, it had kind of used up the medium. Do you know what I mean? It could have used repotting. It could have used repotting so that it wasn't sort of this nasty, funky, you know, mass of decaying roots and worn out soil down there. So, so that's the other thing that I think can interfere with good drainage with these plants.
I think one of the biggest problems with jade plants and with succulents kind of in general is that people get them, let's say they're in their cubicle in their office, and they just have a very slow death in the dark. These plants want lots and lots of sun, the most sun you can possibly give them, and they'll look so good. But, you know, now they're selling succulents in terrariums, which I think that doesn't make any sense at all.
Oh, my God. So that's what's like a rot aerarium. It's going to just rot in there. Oh, that's horrible. Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, anyway, probably, yes, we're suspecting she's right. Watering problem. But being more careful even in the winter, because I think a lot of us do kill our plants in the winter by overwatering. So anyway, those are some tips. So from Regina, also on awaytogarden.com in the comments, she says she's feeling adventurous. What advice do you have, and I'm saying you can, you have on starting native plant seeds for the wildflower garden? She says she tried last year with little luck at raising purple coneflower and pink coneflower. And she wants to know, do we have some advice? I know you're Mr. Propagation over there, aren't you? Didn't you write a book about making more plants?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. So have you started, have any advice on for instance, starting coneflowers from seed?
Well, it's hard to generalize. I'm sitting here thinking of generalizing because seeds like purple coneflower, those are usually kind of the easiest seeds to start, the ones that are little dry seeds that are dry on the plant, and you just sort of sprinkle them almost on the surface of some medium, and they're up in like 3 weeks if you want to do it now, and they're under lights for like 8 weeks. But you can also direct sow them outdoors, and you can do that either in the fall or you can do that in the spring as soon as the soil is about 65 degrees or warmer. But they should be pretty easy. So something happened, I'd say. And also when you buy the seeds like that, if you're buying them from a reputable source, they'll usually have some direction on the seed packet.
Right.
But those shouldn't be too challenging.
I wonder if they need, so you were saying, like, if you started them now under lights and so forth, but would they have had any, do they have any winter requirements and so forth? I don't know with coneflowers, so.
Well, I think that, you know, if you picture them outdoors, they're going to be cold.
Yes.
But generally, those seeds and ones like them need to be dry during the winter. And most of the places that you buy them from, like Prairie Moon Nursery or something like that, they've stored them cold and dry.
I see.
So when you get them, when you buy them and you're going to start them later, not right now, but, you know, closer to when they're going to go outside, like 8 or 9 weeks before they go outside, and then they have to be hardened off and all that stuff. But they're going to be ready and they're going to come up.
Okay. You're promising?
Yeah, I'm
right.
Promising.
Okay, good. Well, and you mentioned a great place, actually. Prairie Moon Nursery does have great cultural tips down to the, you know, variety, species and variety level. So, I mean, species level for all of the prairie-type plants that it does sell, the wildflowers that it does sell. So that is a great place also for Regina to look for, you know, more information on them. So Marianne also has a seed question, actually, which is, it's more general, and it's for the vegetable garden, and she saved some seed. And but in general, the thing that she says is every year is like her problems remembering when to start the seed. And, of course, you know, which needs how much light and which needs warmth and which needs whatever. And, you know, this – generally speaking, when to start what is this mathematical equation that starts with in our temperate zone, in our spring sowing things or late winter sowing things to grow in the summer in the vegetable garden. It starts with knowing what your frost date is, obviously, right? Your final frost date. And then you say, oh, okay, this thing needs 6 weeks indoors under lights, and it can go out 2 weeks after frost, or it can go out at frost time. Well, then you, if it's at, it can go out at frost time, but it needs 6 weeks indoors, you back up 6 weeks, and that's when you sow it. So it's a mathematical equation about the frost date and the time needed and the time before or after that frost date that thing can go out into the indoor environment, be transplanted. So that's how you get your equation. I mean, I know that I'm speaking the obvious to everybody who's listening, but but I forget too, right? And so to make it easier for myself, years ago I started like lumping things, you know, like thinking of groups that I could lump together so that sort of plants that kind of I could start at the same time inside and put out at the same time, roughly speaking, so that I wasn't trying to memorize like 15 different things, but I was sort of having three groups, you know, my cool season growers, my sort of extra cool and extra long, like say onions and leeks, they're sort of extra early. But then like brassicas and other cool season things, some salad-y things that can go out relatively early, and starting those at one time, and then transplanting most of them around the same time, and then my warm season things, my tomatoes, my peppers, my eggplants, and I might hold some a little longer in the house, an extra week or two, but I sort of lump them and started them all at the same time. Anyway, long story short is that to make it easier for myself, I selfishly had a friend program for me a sort of calculator tool, my seed calculator tool on the website, and it has like, you know, all of the most popular vegetables, herbs, annual flowers, and you just put in your frost date, you just pick your frost date, and it'll calculate it for you and tell you when and how long inside and when to transplant relative to your frost date. Yeah, so it's like bing, bang, boom. So don't feel bad, Marianne. I had to build myself a calculator tool to remember.
Well, Margaret, how do you find out? If you don't know what your frost date is, how do you find that out?
So if you know, that's what Google's good for, right? But some of the companies like, the Almanac, the Farmer's Almanac or whatever it's called, and I think maybe Dave's Garden website, that sort of community-based website, and Victory Seed and a number of other places. You know, that's what the Google search will yield you, is a calculator for that. And it's based on, mm-hmm. yeah. So based on National Weather Service, you know, kind of information. So, it's frequently zip code based. You know, you just tell your zip code and so forth. So that's a pretty easy web search. And of course, they seem to have shifted a few days here and there over the years.
Yes.
Not that anything's different outside. none of things are changing. Okay, change the subject. So Chris wrote in with a question about lily leaf beetle. Do you have those, Ken?
Oh, my gosh.
I guess that's a yes answer.
I was so lucky and I didn't have them, and people were complaining about it and I didn't know what it was, and it came down from Canada. Well, about, I think, 2 years ago, they appeared. I guess it was 3 years ago they appeared. The next year, I had no lilies.
Yeah, me too.
Gone. And then the year after, I started dealing with it, which was hand picking them.
Yeah.
Religiously. And the lilies did come back a bit. But it's horrible. What do you do?
A few months ago, and I don't remember exactly when, but within the last 6 months to a year, I did interview an entomologist at the University of Rhode Island, Lisa Tewksbury, to ask her about this, because URI is one of the universities that's been working on this problem, because the Northeast is a place where there's been a concentration of difficulties with the lily leaf beetle, which is an alien pest from elsewhere mm-hmm. that got accidentally imported.
And they're lacquer red, we should
they're
say.
They're very beautiful. They're scarlet red. They're very beautiful, but yeah. They're very gruesome and bad, naughty, naughty. And so URI has a biological control lab where they've worked on identifying and developing protocols for using natural enemies of imported pests to defeat imported pests, you know. So, we talked, and I'll give everybody a link to that conversation, because she obviously is the expert and I'm not. But, they have, they did, through a very long government-approved process, identified natural enemies of the lily leaf beetle from its areas of origin, and did get approval eventually over a number of years to begin using some of these parasitic wasps to infect, hopefully, you know, to release and infect the lily leaf beetles and unhinge them. So in the late 90s or 2000-ish, 2001, there were some of the early releases. I think they did the first ones in like Boston, and there was, I think, some more around New England, and that's really been going well. I think Canada just did its first releases of this parasitic wasp, this natural predator of the lily leaf beetle, a few years ago, and I believe that they're coordinating, URI is coordinating with other states to do so. So there is hope, but meantime, really what you said, Ken, is what we need to be doing, which is, you know, if you just have a few lilies in your backyard, you're going to handpick the adults, and the time that they're going to emerge, they overwinter as adults, and the time that they're going to emerge somewhere near the lily plants is when the lily plants emerge, because that's what they want to, you know, right? That's what they're going to be on and feed on and so forth and reproduce on. That's their plant. So as soon as it's coming up, you've got to be out there looking, and you've got to squish and squish and squish, and they're going to make these horrible, they're going to lay eggs, and you've got to look underneath for the lines of the tiny little bright-colored eggs in a line and, you know, all that kind of good stuff. Neem oil, which is not a broad-spectrum, you know, very, very harmful kind of a thing to use, a substance to use, neem oil is a good material. This Lisa Tewksbury was telling me from URI, and safe to use. So that's another thing that you can do is to use neem oil and hope that these the benefit of these biological controls spreads to your area, because it is a very, very, very tricky pest. So like I said, I'll give a link to the full interview.
Yeah.
We had another imported sort of introduced pest issue question from Laura, which was a mulch question. This was interesting. She said, hemlock mulch is available in my area. The hemlock trees around here already have some woolly adelgid. And for you know what woolly adelgid is, don't you, Ken?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a terrible little, another imported pest that's been decimating the eastern hemlock forests. And so she wants to know, would using hemlock mulch increase the problem? Do you have quarantines and do you have, I don't think in New Jersey you do against the transport of wood materials like firewood and mulches and so forth around the state or from state to state? Do you have that? We have, in New England, we have a lot more of, in New England states, we have a number of states that have such quarantines because of the idea of potentially moving around these pests like New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont. They all have rules against moving wood materials, you know, to try to minimize this kind of problem. I don't think you have that in New Jersey, do you?
No, I don't think so. But yeah. I remember with the Asian longhorn beetle, you weren't supposed to move anything in New York City where it started.
Yes, exactly.
Just in general, I think better safe than sorry.
I totally agree. I totally agree. I totally agree.
You know, you think that mulch is always so, especially with hemlock, it's usually ground up very fine. So you wouldn't think anything could survive there, but who knows? And why take a chance?
Right.
It's probably best not to use it.
Yeah, and I remember when...
Besides, who needs wood mulch? I'm sorry to bring that up right in the middle of everything, but that's like, we don't need wood mulch. There's not really any wood mulch in nature. There are other things that make better mulches, like chopped up leaves, and oak leaves are great, the best. And you can top dress with compost and things like that. That's a whole other story. But, you know, I'm sick of seeing wood mulch, aren't
yeah.
you? Wouldn't you rather see ground covers?
I know. Yeah, I agree with you. I'm not a big user of mulch, wood mulches, except on pathways and so forth. But I remember reading, and I want to say it was the University of Massachusetts, when I was doing a different story about adelgid. You know, they feed on the twiggy areas. So, you know, theoretically, you know, in the parts that are going to be ground up for mulch is more the, you know, trunk, large branches, et cetera. So
right.
Theoretically, and, you know, there's the time of year that you would or wouldn't have their presence and da, 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 da. But the thing is, especially fresh mulch, I wouldn't move it. I wouldn't want to move fresh woody product anywhere, anytime, you know, for the fear of introducing anything, whether adelgid or otherwise. So you could probably get away with it without increasing your risk of adelgid. But why would you even... Why would you risk it? So I agree with you. Better safe than sorry. Better safe than sorry, for sure. So maybe real quick, just one last quick little thing. And I know we could talk for an hour about this one. But Waureen on Facebook wants, her question is, it's actually in quotes, the horrors of clay soil. What's the antidote, Ken?
But the antidote for clay soil is the same antidote as the antidote for sandy soil, which in both cases is to add organic matter. If you have a really bad clay situation, you can also work some gravel into the into the clay soil if it's really bad. If it's the kind of soil that gets rock hard when it dries out and it's hard to re-wet, then it's sticky and slimy when it's wet and stays wet forever. Or maybe pick the plants that really would like that. There are some plants that would like that. But I'd say same answer for sandy, fast draining, and for clay soil that keeps the moisture too long, which is to add more organic matter. And we like compost.
Compost and compost.
Plenty of
compost. And then some more compost.
And then what?
Compost.
Compost?
Yeah. Ken, thank you very much for helping us squander yet another Urgent Garden Questions session. I hope all is well. And I'll talk to you soon, yes?
Thank you so much, okay. Margaret.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach made possible from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners, farmers, and homesteaders with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/A Way to Garden.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
We'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, I hope, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com. Find Ken at kendrews.com. And on Facebook.com, I'm at Facebook.com/A Way to Garden, and happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of AwayToGarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.